But the New England leg of my building a popular anarchism in Ireland, speaking to, I mostly stayed in Boston with members of NEFAC, the Northeast Federation of Anarchist Communists. I took the opportunity to interview four of them about the history of anarchism in Boston, current struggles that are happening in Boston, and how NEFAC is organizing in Boston. This is this interview.
This is MJ.
This is Dawn.
And I'm Diana.
My name is Dominic.
Boston was one of the cities that NEFAC was founded in. It's always kind of been one of the anchors of the Federation. At the moment, we have a combined local union. A couple years ago, we had four smallish collectives that we decided to merge into a local union. And there's positives and negatives about the change, but I think at the moment it's working pretty well for us to have kind of a unitary local organization. Most of what we do isn't under, you know, our name or as an organization necessarily. Right now the bulk of our work for the last 2 or 3 years has been as, you know, one or two individuals participating in campaigns and projects that I would categorize as non-anarchist initiated. And it's been a period that has had its frustrations and its limitations, but it's been really valuable. I think most of us would say it's been pretty valuable in terms of building up experience within actually existing social movements and not just kind of ones that are made up, which seems to be one of the big activities of anarchists in the U.S.
We also try to get involved in local struggles that are happening in our communities and just social struggles. Some of us are involved with a housing campaign. Some of us are involved with labor issues and also pro-immigration campaigns and also work with political prisoners.
Well, I'm specific, so I mean, I've been in Boston a few days and coming across things on a somewhat random basis, but one of the things we did the other night was we went to so it was an award ceremony for the Boston Workers Alliance. Do you want to explain what the Boston Workers Alliance is and what it's trying to achieve?
Well, here in Boston, I don't know if it's just in Massachusetts, but it's called the Corey. Basically, if you try to get a job, they check if you have any criminal history, and if you do, then you can't get a job, basically. And so what happens is a lot of people that do have a criminal history or have been to jail are just facing, you know, that they can't get a job, so they're just in this cycle of poverty and they can't get out, and discrimination. And so this group was formed, the Boston Workers Alliance, and basically what they're trying to do is trying to reform the Corey law so that this discrimination will end, especially most of them are Black people, and they think it's just part of the system that wants to keep them down, wants to keep them in poverty, and wants to keep them going back into jail since they can't find a job. So we went to this fundraiser, and you know, we want to support this project because it's, you know, definitely grassroots. It's the people themselves that are doing this, and it was really great to see some of the people, you know, talking that, you know, they're kind of struggling to fight for that.
And as you point out, it's not just quote unquote, you know, criminal history. It's actually anyone with an arrest for any reason is going to have the show up. You know, when a potential employer looks them up. Now, any employer here actually has access to these records. And one of the reasons that there's kind of a reform angle to it is, it's just a really poorly managed system at the moment. And actually, when you know, the computer prints out the list for a potential hire, the only thing that's readable to somebody who doesn't know what all the different, you know, code stands for is what the charge was. And, you know, the fact that maybe, you know, the case was completely dropped 2 days later, you know, and it was a case of mistaken identity, or, you know, there was no evidence whatsoever, et cetera, that would all be essentially in code. So an employer who's running this kind of background check would just look and say, oh, assault and battery charge, and a bunch of unreadable stuff. So basically anybody who's, you know, the courts and the justice system aside, anyone who's systematically targeted with arrests and street-level harassment by police is going to end up with a Corey record, and it, you know, is a real fetter for getting into the workforce. One of the cool things about, you know, the BWA is they're not really looking at it, you know, as a reform issue. It's you know, kind of a wedge issue that they can use to build what they're looking at and openly talking about as an alliance of unemployed workers.
What else is going on that you consider of importance?
Boston is like I think most very least American cities right now. You know, has experienced a huge housing price surge during the housing bubble. I think it's, you know, one of the, depending on how you look at it, metropolitan area, one of the four or five most expensive places to live in the U.S., you know, up there with San Francisco, New York, Honolulu, Boston. It's definitely one of the top ones. Partly because of that, so high a rise, we are being hit fairly hard by the current, the end of the bubble in terms of foreclosures and defaults on mortgages. So, you know, just in terms of mass bread and butter things, you know, that are issued right now, newsworthy right now. It's definitely housing is kind of coming here to the forefront.
And I think it's important that we're like bringing this out to light because, you know, the banks like tricked so many people with saying like, oh, you can afford this mortgage, like, and so people took these mortgages. So then the interest rate's up, and I was talking with this woman that said that, you know, a couple months ago, her mortgage, her rent was $2,000 a month, and now, because of the interest rates, it was $5,000 a month. So, it's unsustainable. And, you know, and then the banks, because they were, you know, so greedy and were tricking all these people, are now punishing the people for not being able to pay when it's really the banks who should be punished. And I think this is, you know, something that we should definitely be supporting. A lot of people don't know that they have rights and that there's a lot of people like them that are in the same situation. So I think it's important for us to be linking those people together and helping them.
And on a practical level, how is that achieved?
One thing that's going on right now that a lot of NPAC Boston members are involved in one capacity or another is a campaign around post-foreclosure evictions, letting people know that even if they lose the title to the bank, that doesn't mean that they have to lose their home. Which is a pretty, you know, big revelation to some people because it's just kind of assumed you lose and default on your mortgage and you're out of the street. Legally speaking, you become the bank tenant, and there's a campaign underway right now to organize a bank union, effectively, that hopefully will get to the point that can do citywide collective bargaining with lending institutions to make sure that people aren't evicted and stay in their homes. Right now, the campaign is more on a casework basis as it builds, but it's a campaign that has a lot of promise and invited really to help in a couple different stages. Don't want to talk too much about the specifics right now, but pretty excited about some of the ideas and, you know, tactics and strategy this campaign has. I will say that a couple of weeks ago we were involved through this in eviction blockade, which was actually successful. Maybe 70 or 80 folks showed up at the tenant's house. A constable showed up, you know, the moving vans and everything, and called the bank, said what was happening, and the bank said, okay, not today. And a couple of days later, they tried again, but since they heard you're mobilizing for another blockade, they called it off before it even came to it. And that is currently in negotiation, but it looks like that woman will be able to keep her house. And this is actually a pretty rare thing in the U.S. Based on where kind of the class struggle has been the last, you know, 20, 30 years, fairly unheard of to actually, you know, do an eviction blockade that is successful and keep someone in their house. I think it's a big wake-up call that, you know, it is possible. It's exciting to be out and, you know, talk to folks who have seen it in the news and, you know, begin to piece together what we can actually accomplish through that kind of direct action.
I live in East Boston, which is an island on the other side of Boston Harbor from the rest of the city. I'm involved locally in immigrant rights and labor struggle here in the neighborhood and in the surrounding area, as well as housing organizing and political prisoner support.
And Boston's interesting in terms of North American anarchism because, of course, there's quite a historic legacy of anarchism. How far back does that go?
Well, you know, the people that have published about it go back as far as maybe like the early 1800s, starting with transcendentalists and abolitionists. But as far as sort of explicitly anarchist politics, it goes to the mid to late 1800s. The biggest wave of anarchist movement probably happened from the 1890s until the 1930s with a lot of of immigrant anarchists coming from Europe, from Italy, Germany, England, primarily, also Portuguese anarchists, Irish. That's really, you know, the sort of social revolutionary anarchist communist. That was the biggest time period when there was anarchists. But it goes, runs up till today, from the 30s until, I want to say the 90s, it was, you know, very, very small. I think it's still very small, but things are changing, and kind of the things that anarchists are involved in nowadays are, you know, they're more involved in larger social movements, so there's sort of easier to gauge what anarchists are actually doing.
Probably the most famous people externally in terms of Boston anarchism are probably Sacco and Vanzetti. They were active in the city.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Sacco and Vanzetti, personally, I mean, they were involved with sort of a couple of different circles and organizations of anarchists, more or less based in Boston because, you know, it's the major urban area, but they actually lived outside the city. Sacco living, I think, in maybe Milford and Brockton, which are sort of working-class industrial towns, and Vanzetti lived in Plymouth, which is another big town, small city in southeastern Massachusetts, where they were both involved in the labor movement at the time. Vanzetti was involved in a big strike at the Plymouth Cordage Company, which was it was at the time the largest rope manufacturer in the world. And Sacco, I'm not so sure about what exactly he was involved in slavery. Well, he was a shoemaker, but they related to, you know, primarily Italian anarchists organization. One was called Gruppo Autonomo, that were sort of Gallianists, kind of insurrectionary anarchists. They had a social center in East Boston. There was another group in Needham, Massachusetts. There was a group in Lynn. There was a group, couple groups in Boston, mainly in Roxbury and the North End, which is, you know, primarily where people who were Italian immigrants resided. You know, of course, the biggest, the most famous aspect of Sacco and Vanzetti that people hear about is the defense of them during their trial and subsequent execution for, you know, some people say that they were framed for the murder of a payroll clerk in Braintree, although kind of depending on the political perspective of who's telling the story, you know, the innocence or guilt thing is sometimes be cast to the side. It depends on how people want to tell a story. But it's I'm about 25 years old, and well, I am 25 years old, I know, and I can remember, you know, probably from as young as in elementary school, hearing people mention Sacco and Vanzetti. You know, they're sort of folk legends in the area. And I'm sure that the A word was thrown in here and there, but it was, you know, sort of more, a lot of it was more sort of as these kind of criminal folk heroes kind of, or people, or, you know, people who were unjustly persecuted. But I grew up about a mile from where Vanzetti lived, and, you know, definitely my parents had more contact with people who knew them directly and things like that. And there's a lot of stories that still go around, you know, their ghosts sort of haunt the area in a lot of ways, you know, outside of anarchist context. There's been a lot more anarchist interest in their case recently with the 80th anniversary of their execution. And there's actually a Sacco and Vanzetti society that is formed with among anarchists and sort of other leftists as like a commemoration committee, and doing things locally in Boston to bring up their history more and connect it to radical struggles today, and also connect it to immigrant issues today, which is a major issue in Boston and the rest of the United States.
Earlier on, we were watching a video on the Ohio Seven, who were political prisoners from the 1980s. Do you want to explain a bit of the background about their case?
Well, the Ohio Seven, who were actually the group of defendants known as the Ohio Seven, there was actually an eighth defendant named Kazi Ture, who I should say is still a very active kind of organizer and activist in the Boston area. But they were all part of a clandestine organization called the United Freedom Front. Basically came at the tail end of sort of the clandestine armed anti-imperialist movement in the U.S., which came out of the late 1960s, you know, into the 70s. Their backgrounds were, you know, they were a group of working class people, pretty much all either coming out of factories, prisons, or the Vietnam War. A couple of them were Vietnam veterans. And they had a good amount of experience in community, like anti-racist and economic struggles. Lots of ex-prisoners organizing and working with prisoners' families. They were active in anti-racist organizing during the time of busing. In the mid-1970s in Boston, there was legislation passed that desegregated public schools in Boston because of the disparate conditions between schools in white communities and schools in communities of color. So they did things like organized kind of like defense blockades and protected people and families who came under attack from white racists who were opposed to busing. The United Freedom Front, through some of their you know, above ground community organizing and their, you know, their radical political position, came under a lot of harassment and attack from the government, from anything from the local police force in Portland organizing a death squad to attack, you know, the sort of the leadership as well as other participants in the ex-prisoners movement in Portland, to phone taps, just general harassment. There was a member of the group in Portland that was actually raped in the bookstore that they ran. There was just a general, like, overwhelming harassment, and they eventually all went into sort of a clandestine mode and carried out numerous actions, armed actions of bank expropriations and bombings in the Northeast against government and corporate targets that were either upholding apartheid in Southern Africa and supporting death squads in El Salvador. Of course, there was a civil war in El Salvador going on at the time, which was, you know, financed by the U.S. government and corporations. So they essentially were like a U.S.-based anti-imperialist solidarity group that you know, were military in their strategy. They were all apprehended in mid-1980s, and several of them did about 10 or so years in prison. One of them got out in, I want to say, 2004, after 20 years, and two of them, Jan Lahman and Tom Manning, to this day remain in prison. Another one, Richard Williams, died in prison about 3 years ago.
One of the other things I've been asking anarchists I've been interviewing is what they actually make of the elections, because they're kind of interesting with the Obama-Clinton thing in particular. Most people don't have much to say about the Republicans, but that contest seems to have captured the imagination a bit. I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, the Democratic side of things is more interesting. I mean, Boston in general and Massachusetts is like a primarily Democratic state. We always end up electing a Democratic president, a Republican governor, and a Democratic Senate legislature. So it's curious, but pretty much our Republicans are a minority here, and a lot of people take the Democratic Party very seriously and are sort of, you know, caught up in the illusion, which more and more these days over the past 10 years or so, the Democrats have been pushing so far to the right that it's gotten to a point where the distinction is so blurry that I think more people are conscious of that and not necessarily willing to move away from the electoral system or even elect sort of a third-party candidate. But the Obama-Clinton thing is interesting to me and to a lot of people because, you know, if a Democrat wins, we're essentially going to have, you know, either a black president, which has never happened before, or a woman president, who has never happened before. And a lot of debate, mainstream debate, centers on that, you know, that possibility, and it's sort of a great leap forward for the U.S. And in some ways it is. It's in some ways it does represent some, you know, important changes that have happened socially in the U.S. On the other hand, you know, the content of the politics of either politician is pretty horrible. You know, they both sort of make appeals to, you know, to Democrats and to working people in the United States as far as what they're going to do for social programs, what they're going to do for education, maybe international trade agreements and foreign policy. They, you know, don't really talk, or they, well, they do talk about it, but they don't push that as far because they're pretty bad when it comes to that stuff. You know, they both, you know, sort of plans to, they're not, you know, to attack Iran. They don't have a particularly impressive plan to end the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And actually, I mean, if you look at, especially if you look at Obama, you know, he makes no commitment whatsoever to even really start to begin a withdrawal. So the problem with some of that is that there's not even so much these days like a culture of engagement in like electoral politics with a lot of, especially a lot of young people. So people don't really look too deeply into what people's positions are, what candidates' positions are, and young people that get involved sort of, you know, a lot of them, you know, get excited about, you know, maybe they have more anti-sexist or anti-racist politics and see, you know, something positive in having a black president or a woman president. So my personal, you know, take on that is I don't vote in presidential elections on a political principle, but I also am not big on sort of putting energy into these kind of electoral campaigns at the time of elections. I think it makes more sense to talk about that stuff and promote that stuff within active social movements, especially kind of putting it out there as like a strategic question. I'm a member of a labor union that their entire political strategy is electoral, and they lose big time every time, you know, and like it makes more sense for me to kind of go to them, not that there is the space for that in my union, but go to them and say, like, look, you know, we're investing all this money in these politicians that, you know, aside from not acting in our interests, lose so often. And, you know, it's not the electoral thing for me is, it's more of a strategic question than like a sort of like a political principle thing. I think that like the best the way that we can show people that, you know, electoral politics is not the way to go is to show them the strength of sort of mass collective action and social movements. So anarchists having not such a strong connection in social movements for a long time, we don't really have the voice or the credibility to really kind of call it out, you know, out flat, you know, and just say, don't vote because we need anarchism or something like that. I find that those kind of things don't really relate to people, and they end up being a big drain on our resources and energy. The Irish in Boston is, you know, from what I hear, the Irish in Ireland are aware of sort of the political thing. The Irish in Boston have a history of struggle, but they also have a history of like sort of compromise and integration with the power structure. So you have a lot of people, especially in political power and you know, sort of businesses and things like that, but especially in politics, Irish Americans have a lot of power, a lot of sway in things, and that's really, you know, kind of manifested in like you know, in Democratic politics, and in the city of Boston is big. There's a lot of Irish police. I think that's something that like should not be overlooked. You know, it's sort of a stereotype, and it's definitely something that when people portray racist police in the United States, they'll often have a name like Murphy or you know, whatever, you know, they're often portrayed as Irish, which is like, in one way is to, you know, to identify them as white, but in another way it's an interesting thing where a lot of Irish joined the police force and got involved in like a local sort of electoral politics and things like that. And there's always been a crossover between that and organized crime and the, you know, a lot of Irish have been, you know, involved in racism, particularly, like I mentioned before, the busing struggle. There's a community in Boston known called South Boston, which is traditionally a huge Irish community, and that was one of the sort of ramparts of the anti-busing struggle. There was a lot of the anti-busing organizing came out of South Boston, was led by Irish American people, anything from sort of dealing with City Hall and you know, the legislature, all the way down to armed gangs that were going out and actively, you know, attacking people of color and people who were for busing, and that carries on. I mean, I've known and worked with people who were directly involved in that kind of thing, you know, and it's very, very in the culture and the community here, you know, and all that. I mean, South Boston is also where, I don't know what percentage, but where so much resources that went into the Republican movement in Ireland came directly out of that neighborhood, not just this area, but out of South Boston and out of, you know, the Irish community in the United States. And there's a sort of association with people on the left in the U.S. With the Republican movement as being, you know, this righteous anti-imperialist struggle and all these things, and you know, that's very true in a lot of ways. But also the connections here, there's been very there's been, I mean, as far as Irish Americans, you know, they will support, you know, struggle against partition, you know, and against the British occupation of the north of Ireland, unquestioningly. But if you got them, you know, tried to get them to organize in solidarity with black people organizing for justice in Boston, or immigrants, or indigenous people, like, they would more often than not be the one, like the core of the people who are actively resisting, sort of the grassroots right in a lot of ways. I would like to see some way of more cooperation between people in Ireland and people here, as far as sort of countering a lot of that, like those contradictions that exist. I know that Bernadette Michalski, when she spoke in Boston, I think in the 70s, when someone had kind of asked her about her impression of the Irish community in Boston, she said, you know, I would rather, you know, I feel more at home in the black community of Roxbury than I do, you know, among Irish people in South Boston, you know, referring to the kind of racism and contradictions that exist here. And it's true till today. It's really ingrained in sort of popular working class white culture. There's a different kind of racism that exists sort of in the middle and upper class around here. Boston is sort of known as a liberal city, and there's a lot of kind of promotion of this, like, kind of multiculturalism and things like that that go on. But if you really kind of look at things, you know, they kind of prop up a few people of color as, like, you know, tokenize them essentially, and ignore the really kind of economic roots of racism that exists in the city. It's a very, very segregated city, both, you know, economically and racially, and it has a reputation in the rest of the country as sort of being this, you know, bastion of liberalism and multiculturalism, but it's just not the case, you know. And especially, like, I live in a neighborhood that is essentially primarily immigrant neighborhood, most of them coming from Latin America and North Africa. And there's also a huge population of Italian Americans here. And since the big wave of immigrants from to the global south, there's been immense tension, racial tension, among, you know, working class people in the neighborhood, where, you know, you have white people scapegoating, you know, non-white people and immigrants for just about every problem in the neighborhood. And the establishment, the political establishment here, basically ignores, you know, immigrants and people of color across the board when they make their decisions, and, you know, when they sort of appeal to people and try to, you know, get political support. Racism is, it may take a slightly different form than it did, say, 50 years ago or 150 years ago, but it's very real. In this country, white supremacy is very much a part of the class hierarchy in Boston and in the United States in general.